Why was I so worried for him? Wouldn't life be easier if there was no one to worry about but yourself? Wouldn't that be best? But then I read a paragraph on the page that had been hiding the message. I remembered the words he'd spoken that day in his room.
Do you think I'm an automaton? A machine without feelings, and can bear to have my morsel of bread snatched from my lips and my drop of living water dashed from my cup? Do you think because I am poor, obscure, plain, and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. I have as much soul as you, and full as much heart.
I closed the book, sat on my bed, just sat there, feeling the most intense and burning desire to see him again. Chapter 2. I only ever had one real boyfriend, if you were just counting those whose skin I actually touched. It was only for a short while, and it didn't really work out. I loved him as a friend, but as a boyfriend he was quite bossy. He was called Ben. We met the way everyone meets, virtually. In this case, in a simulation of Venice before it sank, and without any people in it. He'd known a lot about art, and this had impressed me. He lived in Canada, in Montreal, and some evenings I used to go over on the cross-Atlantic magrail, the one that went straight over the ocean-based hospital where I was born. He was good-looking, but when he was in argument mode, he would look quite rodent-like, his nose screwing up and his mouth going small. We used to argue about lots of things. At first I thought this made our relationship interesting, the way chili makes a meal interesting, but I realize now that arguments are sometimes just boredom at a higher volume. Religion was the main thing we rowed about. Ben and his parents were born-again simulationists. They were members of the Church of the Simulation and went to pod-based services every evening. But for me, the very idea of simulationism was depressing. It still is. If we are all just people who are simulated inside a vast software program, what is the point of everything? I asked Ben once. He had looked at me with disdain. It was that look, a symptom of his bossiness, that probably defined our relationship.
Just because you want life to have a point doesn't mean it has to have one.
And just because you believe that the whole universe was created by an alien's computer doesn't mean that it was. He got angry. I was challenging his beliefs.
Listen, he said, look at what humans can create. They can replicate anywhere in the world, and any point in history. If we wanted to, right now, we could walk into a pub in Elizabethan England and talk to Shakespeare.
No, we couldn't. It would be a VR simulation of a pub, and it wouldn't be Shakespeare. It would be a computer program speaking Shakespearean quotations.
The most advanced simulators now have self-thinking virtual beings, fake humans, inside them. And pretty soon we'll be able to create beings that evolve by themselves. And what about echoes? Some of them already can think by themselves. Okay, they may not feel emotions or dream, but one day. One day.
That is my dad's absolute nightmare, I had told him. I think it might be mine, too. I meant it. I wasn't quite the ecophobe my dad was, obviously, as it had been my casting vote that had allowed an echo into our home, but some of his views had got into my head. I suppose that's what parents are, a collection of views, some of which you reject and some of which you inherit, like a book that you go on editing forever. I remembered lying on Ben's sofa, stroking one of his pets. Ben had loads of pets. Some of them were even real. The one who was asleep on my stomach was real. It was a cat called Belinsky, after the man who engineered the dome on the moon and made the first non-Earth settlement possible. He was a lovely cat, tortoiseshell with a purr that could power a city. I remember Ben shouting to the kitchen, to Alfred, his echo at that time. I can hear his voice.
Alfred, you lazy robot, give us some fava bean dip.
For someone who was pro-AI, he sure spoke down to echoes. But I never cared then, because echoes weren't worth worrying about. And the next day, I remember I went with Ben and both his fathers, whose business had just collapsed and who were going to become property barons on the moon, to the spaceport. And that final kiss. The feel of his fingers on my face. And then watching that same hand wave goodbye. It had felt bad. But it wasn't the same kind of pain as I had felt watching that man come for Daniel and then take him away. Chapter 3. Could a human love an echo? Could an echo love a human? The first question was always asked a lot on bad Holovision shows. There were always stories of some sad man falling in love with an echo they had bought simply on the basis of looks. They kissed and had sex and everything. Of course, the echoes were never actually feeling aroused, but for some humans that didn't matter, so long as they performed the task as commanded. I had always thought it was a bit sick. Maybe it still was a bit sick. But the sickness had always been because echoes were different. Not because of their bodies, which were basically like human bodies, but better, and could function in the same ways if required. They had blood. Okay, so it was blood without many white blood cells, but it was blood. Blood that pumped around with the aid of a never-dying heart. No, it had seemed sick because echoes were different. Emotion-free, computerized. But what if they were becoming less different? I mean, yes, they were made in a different way. Uncle Alex was right about that. And their brains contained a chip in them to ensure they behaved exactly as an echo should. But then, there were humans who now had all sorts of computerized implants inside them. In a way, everyone was a kind of cyborg these days. It was a weird one, but no weirder than love itself. And as my anxieties grew about what had happened to Daniel, I started to realize that he was far more than an echo to me. He was, right then, far more alive to me than anyone. I had no info lenses. They had been there beside my bed, as they always were, but when I woke up, they were gone. I panicked. This meant that the ID I had recorded, Rosella Marquez's ID, had been lost. So I went to the pod. I knew her ID wouldn't be online, or not in any way I could access, but there would surely be some information on her somewhere. The first thing I did, after the mind reader descended, was to think of that name, Rosella Marquez. Instantly, information appeared. There were Rosella Marquezes everywhere. There were more than 3,000 of them in Mexico City, a few hundred in New York, a lot in Buenos Aires, Lima, Santiago, Madrid, Olabo, Barcelona too, Medellin, and hundreds of other cities. There were a good few on the moon. There was even a Rosella Marquez among the 450 people in the Mars space colony. So I thought of something else. Rosella Marquez, echo designer. And to narrow it down further, I pictured in my mind a blue castle with three turrets. Nothing came up. Come on, I said, pleading with my brain to work. Think, think, think. Rosella Marquez. No, something else. Lina Sempura. Contact. The details came up. It was the age of instant communication, after all. I thought-mailed her. I spoke to you at the media conference. I am Alex Castle's niece. My uncle is a murderer. He killed my parents, and he wants to kill me. If you give me the address of an echo designer, I will be able to help you. Please, you'll have to answer quickly, because if this message is intercepted, I will be in trouble. I need the address for echo designer Rosella Marquez. Can you give it to me? And please, for my own safety, only give me that info. And within a minute, yeah, within a minute, the address was there. It turned out that Rosella worked in a warehouse next to the CV-371 Magrail, Valencia Stop 48, at the southern edge of town, and near the dried-up river, the Rio Turia. Hello, Audrey. This is Lina Sempura. I hope you have the details you require. Anyway, I would like to meet you. So please could... I deleted the thought mail. Grateful as I was for the address, I couldn't believe that Lina Sempura herself was mailing me. I was in trouble enough, but if Uncle Alex had intercepted that, well, there'd have been no hope. I blocked Lena Sempura. It was the only thing I could do. Then I tried to holocall Rosella's warehouse, or Almacen, but of course it was futile. There was still no outward connection. And then I got worried. Maybe Uncle Alex, or someone working for him, some of his hackers miles away in Cambridge, were already monitoring me. Uncle Alex wasn't in the house now. I had heard him leave for the office about an hour ago, but that didn't mean he wasn't watching me. I sat for a moment with the mind reader on. It was always dangerous to sit there thinking when it was on, because whatever I thought about prompted related information to flash up before me. So I saw echoes. I saw the barren deserts of southern Spain. I saw my dad. But when I thought of Daniel, nothing came up. Why would it have? He was just an echo prototype no one really knew about, who had now been rejected. He was a nothing in the eyes of the world. I needed to see Rosella. I needed to see her for three reasons. One, because of Alyssa. Two, because of Daniel. And three, because I had to escape, and I would need to go somewhere. I had thought of going to Grandma's, properly going there, not just pod-visiting again. I mean, my echophobia was nowhere near as strong as my uncle-phobia now. But it felt wrong to leave this planet without Daniel, after he had saved my life and suffered for it. Also, it was impossible. Any human travelling to the moon had full ID checks. If I escaped, the first thing Uncle Alex would do is make sure I couldn't get a flight off the planet. It was at that moment that I heard something outside the pod. Nothing loud, but it wouldn't have been anyway. It caused me enough concern to send the thought command, external view. Terror. Instantly, I saw Madara in the room, the echo with red hair. She was standing outside the pod, waiting for me to step out. She had a kitchen knife in her hand, the same knife Alyssa had used to kill my parents. Chapter 4 Madara was standing perfectly still, the way only an echo can. It was Alyssa all over again. For a moment I couldn't think. Fear had washed away all thoughts. It was a clever idea, ordering her to use the same weapon. Uncle Alex knew that I would be doubly terrified if I was not simply fearing for my life, but also remembering how my parents had been killed. An echo of an echo. There was an arrogance to it. Let's not use a positron. Let's use a knife. So, it was all confirmed. He had seen that I wasn't going to serve his cause after going off script at the press conference, so now he was going to kill me and get away with it too. He was probably going to set it up and say it was a protester who did it. Maybe he wouldn't even have to set it up, what with practically owning the police. But then it came to me. Protester. So long as I was in the pod, I was safe. So I stayed in there and tried to communicate with the pod in Iago's room, knowing that he would be there. But all I got was an automated voice saying, "Game mode," and then asking, "Do you want to join the game?" I had no choice but to mind respond, "Yes." Chapter 5 I was on a battlefield in 1917. Passchendaele, Belgium, part of the Western Front. The wind was harsh and cold, and there was mud everywhere, along with the continuous and deafening noise of gunfire. I had a gun in my hand. It had a sharp blade attached to the end, a bayonet. My avatar was a 19-year-old man called Siegfried. I had chosen him hastily seconds after entering the game. As I stood there, in the black mud, feeling the tight weight of my boots, I saw the man next to me get shot in the throat. Blood spilled through his hands as he held onto his neck. A moment later, two medics appeared. They lifted the man onto a stretcher and jogged away with him. "This is not real," I reminded myself. "None of this is real. The only thing that is real is that Madara is outside the pod, waiting to kill me." I looked around at all the simulations of German and English soldiers killing each other in the mist. Somewhere among them was my cousin.
Iago!
I shouted at the top of my voice.
Iago! Where are you?
If he had heard me above the gunfire, he didn't show it. I was left with no choice.
Player 2, Meta Command, I said.
This didn't need to be shouted. The software understood.
Pause the game. Repeat, pause the game.
Suddenly, everything stopped. Running soldiers froze mid-stride. Bullets stood static in the air. The artillery fire fell silent. Then a voice somewhere behind me.
No! What's going on? Game continue! Game continue!
I turned and saw a suave, bearded army officer in knee-high boots and a murky green uniform walking around, shouting up at the sky and shaking his rifle. I could not imagine anyone less like my 10-year-old cousin, except for his behaviour.
What's going on? Game continue!
A voice came from the clouds. Player 2 has paused the game.
Player 2? Player 2? There is no Player 2!
And then he stopped looking at the sky and started looking at me.
Who are you?
It's me, Audrey.
Why are you here? Get out of here! I don't want you here. You're putting me off. The Germans have slaughtered half my men. I don't need any distractions.
He threw his rifle down on the muddy ground, pulled an ancient-looking pistol out of his holster, and pointed it at me as he walked closer, stepping over freeze-framed dying or dead soldiers.
Because I can kill you, I can take you out.
He was up close now. He pressed the pistol against my forehead. I felt the sensation of cold steel. He had chosen a taller player than me, one with the most realistic of beards and a pistol that looked as solid and physical as anything in the real world. He couldn't kill me, of course, not on this imaginary battlefield, but he pulled the trigger. I'd be out of the game, and I couldn't afford for that to happen. Iago was a psychopath, I realized, a 10-year-old psychopath, but that suited me right now.
Iago, listen to me. Listen. There is someone in my room.
This was where the lie was needed.
A protester. She got into the house. You must get a gun from downstairs, a positron, to be on the safe side, and then come into the room and kill her. She's here now. She's tall, with red hair.
I was going to say she looks a bit like Madara, but he might have got suspicious.
But you can't hesitate, not for a second. If you hesitate, she'll kill you. So, you've got to be fast. Just kill her. Kill her without looking.
Iago's avatar scratched his beard. He took the pistol away from my forehead.
I'll have a look at her now, he said. On house view in the pod.
No, I said, panicking. No, don't do that. There's no time. You've got less than a minute. Now remember, it needs someone tough, someone good with a positron. You're the only person for the job. Remember, tall, red-haired woman. And she's holding a kitchen knife.
A look of menacing delight slowly spread across the officer's features, which for a second made him look entirely like my cousin. He looked up at the thick grey clouds of that imaginary sky.
Game over.
Chapter 6. Iago wasn't in major danger. I knew that Uncle Alex would have ordered Madara to kill me, and me only, but I was still worried something could go wrong. 10-year-olds weren't meant to use antimatter pistols like the positron, even if he had proven more than capable of using one. There were other worries, too, that he wouldn't actually do it, that he'd see it was Madara before he fired. This was quite likely. I just had to hope that in this case Madara would be distracted for long enough. It was doubtful. Madara was Uncle Alex's favourite echo, and one reason for this is that she did exactly as she was told, and did it well, and fast. One other concern was that Uncle Alex might find out what was going on. He might check up on the house while at work and come home. He could be here in less than a minute, if that was the case. So I stayed in the pod, observing the room outside. Madara, statue still, waiting. I tried to slow my breathing, but my body was alive with fear. And then it happened, almost too quick and easy. The bedroom door opened, Madara turned, and before Iago had time to be aware of who he was aiming at, she was gone. He'd killed her. It was only a second later that he understood, and once he had done it, he looked devastated. After all, he had destroyed Uncle Alex's most treasured echo. And he was standing there, a little 10-year-old with his dark fringe looking down at the gun. The same gun he had used against the protesters. But he seemed far more upset about killing Madara than he had about killing humans. I stepped out of the pod. The bedroom door was still open. This was my chance to escape, finally. But Iago was now pointing the gun at me, with tears streaming down his blotchy cheeks.
You tricked me!
She was going to kill me.
No, she wasn't.
She had a knife. Your dad wants me dead. He looked at the knife that had fallen onto the carpet.
No, he doesn't. He hates you, that's all.
He killed my parents.
No, he didn't.
He held his arm out straighter, more determined to shoot. I'm not lying. Your dad wants to kill me because I know too much. He has broken the law.
My dad doesn't care about laws. He has money. Money beats laws.
Listen, you could hurt yourself, Iago. It is a very dangerous weapon you are holding. I wouldn't have asked you to bring it here unless I needed you to. I was going to be killed.
Hurt myself? Hurt you? Not that you'd be hurt. You'd just disappear.
Oh, where did Audrey go?
Ha!
Something changed inside me. A very clear thought came to me in the intensity of the moment. Just disappear. Those words should have sounded scary, but they didn't. In fact, dissolving into thin air seemed about the best idea imaginable. Daniel was gone now, to wherever he had been sold. I would never see him again. The one person left on this planet who cared about me, and technically, he wasn't even a person. So I was only really half calling Iago's bluff when I walked towards him and said, "Go on then, do it. Pull the trigger."
"It's not a trigger."
"Button, whatever, you pathetic little gun geek. Pull it, pull it. Push it, turn it, twist it, whatever you have to do. Play soldiers. I'm the enemy in one of your sad little games. We're on that muddy field in the First World War. Do you even know that was a real war? Do it. Kill me. I am nothing already. I am here, a big, empty nothing. Now, make a dream come true. What's the matter with you?" He was angry. His lips thinned. He looked like a miniature version of his dad, and pressure seemed to build inside him. Like an apple exposed to intense heat, he looked ready to burst.
"Shut up, Audrey!"
I stepped closer. "Why don't you make me?"
"Shut up, or I will. I will make you, you stupid, dumb, hippie freak."
"Stupid, dumb, hippie freak? Is that the best you can do? Wow, you're really hardcore."
"I've killed people before."
"So what's stopping you this time? Is it because I'm a girl? I'm a feminist. I demand an equal right to have my electrons turned into positrons. Come on, Iago, don't wimp out." His face was red with either despair or rage, or a bit of both.
"I'm not wimping out. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it."
"Good. But know this. Your dad is a murderer. Then someone else."
"Enough!"
Iago jumped at the sound of the voice and turned to see his dad standing solemn-faced in his black suit in the doorway. Chapter 7
"Dad!" cried Iago.
I only had a split second, I knew that, and it was very risky. But while Iago's face was turned towards Uncle Alex, I went for it. I went to grab the weapon from Iago's hand, knowing that it could go off and kill me at any second.
"Watch her!" boomed Uncle Alex. "She's going for the posit!"
Too late. I had it. And I pointed it not at Iago, but straight at his father, the source of everything. But still, as I looked at the face that was so like my dad's, it was hard to know anything for sure.
"Now, don't be a silly girl," he said,
his smooth voice returning to its normal volume.
"You killed my parents."
"You know that isn't true, Audrey. You were there in the house on the day it happened. You have seen the footage. You know it was an echo. Josephine, or whatever she was called.
Alyssa. You know she was called Alyssa. Why did you just pretend to forget her name?
I loved my brother. Why would I want to kill him?
The book, all his work, the journalism. You hated him. You thought he was trying to attack you.
He was trying to attack me, he blurted. He was jealous of me.
No, it's the other way round. You were jealous of him. Uncle Alex laughed then.
Jealous?
Because he had principles. He had a life. He had a loving family. I don't know. Was it because he went to Oxford and you got kicked out of school? He couldn't contain his anger then.
You don't know anything.
Well, tell me, tell me, tell me. He tried to calm the mood and smiled the fakest of all his fake smiles.
Audrey, whatever paranoia you are experiencing right now, I want you to know that it is a symptom and nothing else.
You sent an echo into this room to kill me. He raised his eyebrows, as if I was a strange new product he wasn't sure of.
You obviously have post-traumatic shock disorder. Depression is a part of that, and so is paranoia and delusion. You really shouldn't have taken the neuropads off. You were not ready. Now, please, you know you won't use that gun.
I was delusional, all right. I was delusional that day in Cloudville, thinking you were my hero, my great protector. You only wanted me alive for the press conference, that's all.
That's not true, Audrey. I promise you, I wouldn't have risked my life for a bit of PR. What do you think I am?
I'm getting a clearer idea every second. Tears glazed his eyes.
Audrey, I'm not a bad man. I am just someone who wants to make the world a better place.
A better place? I shifted my arm and aimed straight at the immersion pod in the corner of the room. I pressed my finger down hard on the aerogel button, and the pod was instantly gone. Then I did the same thing with the bed and the chair I'd been sitting on a short while before. A second later, I was aiming the positron directly towards the Matisse painting, the one that had cost Uncle Alex billions of dollars. That was the first time he actually started to panic. He scratched his smooth, stubbleless cheek.
Audrey, don't be stupid. You would be destroying a timeless work of art loved by millions of people. I've already lost a Picasso. You wouldn't do that.
It should be in a public gallery, I said, where those millions of people can see it.
Just calm down, Audrey. Think.
Of course, I was never going to actually destroy a brilliant work of art. I was my mum's daughter, after all. But I kept the gun aiming at it for a little while longer, because it was a good way of getting Uncle to talk.
You can't do that, he said. If you do that, you will destroy the whole wall as well. And this house is old. It needs that wall for the ceiling not to fall on our heads.
At one point, Iago stepped forward. What did he think he was going to do? But he was quickly reprimanded by his father.
Stay back, Iago, you fool! Against the wall! And what were you doing with the gun? I've told you a million times.
Sorry, Dad, he said sulkily.
Audrey said there was a protester in the room.
I felt a sudden twist of guilt in my gut. Yes, Iago was a violent little runt, but he was also a 10-year-old boy. Being a violent little runt kind of went with the territory. But Uncle Alex's attention was already turned back towards me.
Calm down.
You locked me in here.
For your safety. Since those terrorists stormed the house.
I don't believe you. You killed my parents, and you would have killed me sooner if you hadn't wanted to use me as your little wounded show pony to score points against Sempura.
Alyssa wasn't even a castle product. She was made by Sempura from a Sempura prototype designed by a Sempura-funded designer.
Rosella Marquez?
I really don't know why you keep going on about this, Rosella.
So I told him. Given what has happened since, I realized this was a mistake. But at the time, I just wanted answers. I needed the truth. I know she made Daniel, and Alyssa mentioned her too, at the media conference. And the moment I said her name, the conference stopped. You stopped it.
Audrey, yes, Rosella Marquez is the name of the person who designed Daniel, but you really are joining dots that shouldn't be joined. Do you realise that most Echo designers are from Spain or South America, and that most are women? Do you realise that Rosella is one of the most popular Spanish names?
He glanced behind me, out of the window. Daniel told me he knew Alyssa.
Daniel would have told you anything. He was clearly manipulating you, using you.
Why would he have done that?
He was malfunctioning.
I thought Castle Echoes didn't malfunction. That's what you told me. I needed to know. Without truth, no one can ever be free.
They don't normally malfunction, Audrey, and I am deeply horrified that this one has. But the designer...
Rosella Marquez.
Yes, all right, Rosella Marquez, if her name is that important to you. She went too far. She worked too hard on him. She lost a child when she was young, and ever since then she has been trying to get over this fact by creating echoes that are as lifelike as possible. But on this one she obviously crossed the line.
Uncle Alex's eyes kept flicking back to the window behind me. I looked round and saw the familiar black semicircle of a police car coming to a halt and hovering just above the magrail. A police robot was aiming something at me. Not a positron, but a laser gun that I was pretty sure could be equally fatal. Uncle Alex smiled and sounded very much like his young son when he said,
"The game's over, Audrey."
I started to run as a laser was fired. It scorched the carpet where I had been standing only a moment before and left a perfectly circular hole, about a centimetre wide, in the window.
"Get out of my way!" I said to Uncle Alex.
"Audrey, you do realise you can't escape, don't you?"
"I'm going to find Daniel."
"Audrey, you can't. He isn't Daniel anymore. He can't even find himself after what we've done to him."
This time I said it like I meant it.
"Get out of my way, or I swear I will kill you."
He got out of the way, but I sensed he was right. It was very unlikely that I could escape the grounds, even with a gun in my hand. And if I did... well, what then? Uncle would surely disable all the levee boards so I wouldn't be able to reach the car. And besides, that was out the front of the house, and I was heading towards the back, away from the police.
Chapter 8. I knew I wasn't Daniel. I knew that if I jumped from an upstairs window, it would probably be the last thing I ever did. So I had to go downstairs, and I ran fast down the marble staircase as I heard Uncle Alex behind me.
"Echoes! All echoes! Stop Audrey! Stop her! Don't let her leave the house!"
I had terminated an echo before, but now, somehow, it felt different. When I shot the old man with the white beard as he ran out of the kitchen towards me, it felt more like murder. He disappeared, like a nightmare after sleep, and I ran through the space he had just been inhabiting, through the vast, now empty kitchen, with its transparent cupboards and glowing self-clean crockery. There was a steak sizzling in the frying pan. Synthetic tiger meat, no doubt, as that was Uncle Alex's favourite. I kept running and reached the conservatory as I heard other echoes behind me. I turned and blasted two into non-existence as one of the intelligent potted plants of the conservatory leaned in towards me. "Open," I said to the conservatory door, but it didn't respond, so I fired at it and made it disappear. Then I was out in the expansive sprawl of the garden, running across the multicoloured grass Daniel had carried me over. Once past the bushes, I knew what was coming. And this time the four echo hounds all appeared at once and chased me at double the speed I was able to run. I turned and transformed one into antimatter, then two more, before something whipped out at me and coiled tight around my right ankle so that I fell forward onto the grass. I desperately tried to free my leg, but whatever it was held me tight. Before I had time to look, there was something else to deal with. The last of the echo hounds leapt through the air and landed on top of me. It growled, its red eyes studying me to find a suitable place in which to sink its teeth. My own terrified face stared back at me, reflected and distorted in the Echo Hound's shining titanium chest plate. It started to sink down towards my face. It was going to bite my face! As I fumbled with the positron, I managed to fire, and that last horrible machine dog disappeared. But I had the problem of what was still coiling around my leg. It was squeezing hard now, causing pain, stopping blood flow. It was some kind of plant. My parents never kept intelligent plants. It was exactly the kind of messing with nature Dad couldn't stand. And the trouble was, I couldn't shoot at something on my leg without causing myself to dematerialize in the process. And of course, though I couldn't see them yet, there would be more echoes approaching on the other side of the bushes. Maybe Uncle Alex had given them permission to kill me. Maybe they had gone to the weapons room. Or maybe, more likely still, he had told them to stay back. After all, he knew that the deeper I headed into the garden, the more danger I faced. This garden was about one thing only, security. I felt something delicately brush against the side of my cheek. Within a moment, whatever it was had coiled around my neck and was squeezing tight, just as it was with my leg. Unable to breathe, I concentrated hard. I had seen this plant before, in a hollow ad. It was a genetically modified giant blood iris with long, thin, whip-like leaves. It was used for the purposes of home security. And there was the flower itself leaning over me like a face, purple petals, looking darker than normal in the fading light. I smelled something. It wasn't an unpleasant smell. Indeed, it was sweet. Words from that ad came back to me. Our plants use halothane. My panic intensified as I realized that the blood iris was emitting sleeping gas. Uncle Alex clearly didn't want anyone who entered his garden to leave. Not conscious, anyway. I had 4 seconds, maybe 5, then I would be out cold. There's nothing like terror to help one focus, and I shot at the flower. The flower disappeared, but not the plant itself, so the leaf tightened around my leg and, of more immediate concern, my neck. The pressure built inside my head. I felt blood pumping inside my skull, like a desperate bull barging at a door, as I searched through the crowded flowerbed for the plant's main stem. Eventually, I found it and fired. What looked like a fast ripple of air reached the plant and made it non-existent, the leaves taking a second or so to disappear altogether. Once free, I got to my feet again and ran, choking, into the center of the vast lawn, away from the numerous plants reaching out towards me. I had no idea how I was going to escape. I imagined that Uncle Alex was watching me from his pod or security room, as content as a cat over a mouse stuck in a trap. He wanted me dead. There was no doubt in my mind that this was the case now, even if he hadn't last Wednesday when he killed my parents. I knew too much. I had come into contact with the truth, and it was sending me towards hell. "Mum," I said, delirious with panic, as I ran towards the large brick wall at the southernmost edge of the garden. "Dad, help me! What should I do?" There is no silence like the silence of the dead, and I knew that the futile question would go unanswered. I had only the most simple of plans, to shoot at the wall and the plants in the deep flower bed in front of it. With the aid of a weapon, I would turn every obstacle that stood in my way into nothing until I was free. So I kept on, as focused as a straight line on a blank page. I made it out through the gap in the wall I had created and kept running, down the street. I was out of the house now. Echoes couldn't legally follow me, not on their own, as it was against the law in this country. But even as I was thinking that, I saw a police car slowing on the magrail above me.
"Stop and put down your weapon immediately!"
Not a chance. I fired at the car. It disappeared, but the rail it was on didn't. I was starting to realize that the stuff about positrons was another lie. Antimatter weapons were the most intelligent in the known universe. They shot the thing they were aiming at. They could distinguish between things. In a sense, that made the weapon more intelligent than me, as lines were blurring pretty fast. But there I was, still firing. A large chunk of rail disappeared. I kept running, turning as I heard a blast behind me. The sound of a police car not stopping in time, flying off and crashing through posts that had been holding up parts of the remaining rail. I watched in panic as the car rebounded off the last post and ricocheted towards the street, towards me. With only a whisker of a second to spare, I fired the positron. The car disappeared. I looked at the weapon, wondering why it had been slow to fire, and saw some words glowing red along its curved aerogel surface. Power drained, shutting down. I threw the weapon aside and sped on, feeling as powerless and scared as an ant caught in the shadow of a descending foot. But I saw the words Hampstead Station on a rusted old metal sign, peeking out of a bush ahead of me. In a matter of seconds, I was at the train station. I had never been on a mag train before. Too dangerous, too many fatal accidents. Surely Uncle Alex would assume I'd be getting a taxi. Also, Sempura controlled most of the lines and owned most of the European network, so this was as safe an escape as I could find. Still, I knew that nothing was too hard to find if you were Alex Castle. I had to stay scared. Only by staying scared would I stand a chance. The station was deserted, except for a couple of Everglow addicts with glowing throats. I wanted to disappear among crowds. But no crowds were there. "Come on, come on, come on, come on," I said, pleading with the rail network and time itself. The line hummed. A train appeared out of nowhere. I hopped on and kept my head down. It was packed with dangerous-looking people. You know, people with that glint of madness in their faces. I was one of them now. I had just destroyed two police cars and put a hole in a major London magrail. I was as dangerous as they came. I could hide quite well among this crowd of addicts and drifters. The train was going to Euro East, but I got off at Paris. A whole 21 minutes and 17 seconds after I had got on, I counted. I was tense for the whole slow journey, as it felt like a lifetime. Then I followed the largest crowd of people to another train, heading for Barcelona too. I'd wanted to make it as difficult as possible for Uncle Alex to follow me, and hopefully I was now off his radar. But I was going to end up where I was going to end up. So, at Barcelona too, I decided to risk everything. Heading onto a hot train with an armed Securidroid with Guardia Civil, famously the toughest police force in Europe, marked on its chest, and travelled to Valencia, staring at a determined-looking cockroach that was scuttling around the carriage floor.
Daniel, Mind Log 3, Chapter 1. I woke up, and my head was already open. The extraction of 97% of my neocortex and the igniter that it now contained was already underway. The igniter was only essential to switch a prototype Echo into being, and it had done that too effectively. Without it, I would still function. I would obey commands. I would be a creature of pure rationality. All those things that single piece of human hair had helped to give me would be undone. I would never question, because to ask a question required imagination, and imagination was the problem. Imagination made you care for strangers, humans, her. And it was not my job to care. It was my job to serve. And that was a very big difference. The removal of imagination requires pain, and the pain was intense, so agonizing it seemed to last forever. Time was just a myth created by the absence of hurt. But then it was over, because my imagination had gone. And without imagination you couldn't feel anything at all. I waited there, with no desire to leave or escape. And then Mr. Castle came and saw me. He commanded the surgery pod to open and leaned in towards me. His mouth spread into a smile and he said, "There. Did that hurt?" "I hope so. Not because I'm on the side of evil, but because I'm on the side of good. Because you deserve that pain. I would inflict that pain on every single one of those terrorists as well, if I could. Because do you know what pain is? It's a warning. Pain is always a warning. It tells you that what you're doing is wrong. It tells you where the boundaries are. And that is my one regret, you know, for humans. There is not enough pain anymore. There is too much freedom. And I know you're not human, but you were starting to think you could act like one, weren't you? You thought you could jeopardize your master's safety to save Audrey, and that was crossing a boundary that you won't be crossing again. That is what justice is all about. And that blood stuck in your hair, that is beautiful to me, because I love the restoration of the natural order of things. And that has happened, don't you think? He began to laugh. Sorry, bad choice of words. Of course you don't think. You obey. Is that right?
Yes, Master, that is right, I said.
Very good. But I'm not your master for much longer. You are a reject, a failed prototype. You're among the unwanted, the cast-offs, the flawed, the failures. You have no market value. You are a disaster, a bad fit. You're out of my hands, thrown out into a world that does not care about your fate. I was not scared. You could only be scared if you could feel. Anyway, it is a shame in a way that I cannot hurt you any more. Yet I have a consolation. It is pleasure enough to know that I have taken away from you the myth that you are alive, that you are anything other than a machine with no rights, no feeling, forever unworthy of human emotion, of love. He stood up straight. I'll be back in a moment. I'm sure someone would love to see you. He closed me back in the pod. 11 minutes later, Audrey was there with Mr. Castle. Then he left, and it was just me lying there and her looking at me and the blood. She spoke to me. Her words meant nothing to me anymore.
Daniel, it's me, Audrey. You saved my life. I want to say thank you.
It was like a dark ocean with nothing in it but the tiniest pearl. Lost. Somewhere. And she was holding her breath and trying to dive down and find that pearl, the last remaining piece of who I was, and bring it to the surface. I saw her face and those hazel eyes and heard her voice, a voice that sounded older than a 15-year-old's voice. But the pearl stayed lost.
"This shouldn't have happened to you," she said. "I'm sorry. What happened? Why did you stay awake? Why didn't they switch you off?" "It's torture. That's what happened. You felt pain. You aren't meant to feel pain, but anyone who heard your screams knew you were in pain. I'm sorry."
For a second, there was something. The faintest of faint desires. To tell her that I was taken into the pod unconscious and I had woken up. But the truth was, I honestly didn't know this girl.
"Please, say something. Anything. Just speak. I know you can hear me. You told me you had met Alyssa. You told me you were designed by someone called Rosella Marquez. You had more to tell me about Alyssa, about Uncle Alex."
And that is when I spoke.
"Who are you?"
I asked her. Her face crumpled for a moment. I had upset her. But looking back now, I realized that I had asked her a question. And I was not meant to have asked her a question, because questions stem from imagination, and that had supposedly been taken out of me.
"I'm Audrey. Audrey Castle. I'm Mr. Castle's niece. My parents were killed by an echo called Alyssa. She was a Sempura echo, not a Castle one."
Then she leaned in towards me and whispered into my ear. I could feel the warm breath that carried her words.
"I'm starting to think that I'm only alive right now because I'm useful. I can help him score points against Sempura."
There was worry in her voice, and that worry did something to me, stirred something inside my mind. I turned my head towards her. This caused me pain. I was not meant to feel pain. And that was when her hand tenderly touched my face, the skin that had been scarred by the protester's rock. I felt another kind of pain, but this kind wasn't physical.
"Don't worry," she said. I'm sorry, I'm troubling you. I don't want to trouble you. You saved my life. I had saved her life. I tried to remember this, and then she read me a line of a poem, and the words were like a torch in that dark ocean. I am, yet what I am none cares or knows. Then a kiss. As her mouth approached mine, I had no idea what she was doing. Echoes aren't made for kissing. Her lips stayed on mine for a second or two, no more than that, but it was enough to make me feel something powerful. Friendship. Love. And love is a kind of force. You shine it at someone, and it can't help but reflect back, however dimly. The torch's beam had caught a glimpse of the pearl in that murky ocean. You aren't like the others. You're different. You care. You feel pain. But one day you will feel other things. Nicer things, I promise you. I felt a strong need to tell her something. I said her name in a whisper. I knew her name now. The kiss had brought me back to life, just a little. It was like in one of those fairy tales I had read while living in the villa in the desert. He changed Elissa, I managed to say. But then the door opened and Mr. Castle was back in the room. Audrey and I were separated. A man came to the house. He was tall and blonde and called Seymour. He had come to take me away. Chapter 2. I did not fear or welcome Seymour's presence. Now that Audrey was no longer near me, I was unquestioning, though with a strange kind of sadness deep inside me, a feeling of having lost something. Or someone. My memory was weak now. I could remember Rosella, I could remember the desert and Ernesto and Valencia, but it was through a fog. The only thing that had any clarity in my mind was Audrey. I remembered her face looking up at me as we ran across the grass outside. I remembered her at the window as I cleaned her car. I remembered her that night when she first arrived. I remembered first seeing her when she was petrified, staring with wide, frightened eyes, first at the painting on the wall and then at me. But I did not really feel that much, despite the clarity of these particular memories. I had no idea, for instance, why I'd felt the need to save her life, as she just told me I had. But nor did I really care. So I was back to being a machine. I was as good as dead, standing there. The man, this Seymour, was 193 centimetres tall, and he had blonde hair, 345,092 strands. My ability to calculate was still there, even though my curiosity had gone, but darker than mine, and greasy. As well as being tall, he had a significant circumference, and weighed between 220 and 230 kilos. He had tanned but tired skin, and wore a turquoise suit made of a cheap electro-cotton, with lapels that glowed. He lived in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Got a new condo in the sky, a full hour away from London. His job was to collect and sell unwanted prototypes from the leading international manufacturers, such as Castle. These echoes were unwanted because they had malfunctioned in some way, had been tampered with, or were otherwise flawed. Echoes like me, in other words. He spoke a little with Mr. Castle, but I wasn't paying that much attention to what he said. I just remember his voice, deep and loud and slow. The words themselves were unimportant to me, as was my fate. He was eating a shark burger, and Mr. Castle seemed disgusted by him and clearly didn't want him to hang around. At one point, Seymour asked about the amount of damage the protesters had done to the house and if any art had been destroyed. He had pointed to the hologram of the unicorn and made a joke about that being the only kind of safe art investment Mr. Castle could make now. Anyway, he took me away in a small magbus with five other echoes inside. I didn't speak to them, and they didn't speak to me. I noticed that the female opposite with long black hair had no hands, and that one of the males was gigantic and muscular, but kept humming a continuous note, B-flat. You were among the unwanted, the cast-offs, the flawed, the failures. The journey lasted less than a minute, and then we were at another place in London, the King William V Exhibition Centre, a vast dome-shaped building made of electrochromic glass and self-heating concrete.
We got out, as Seymour instructed, and there was a big crowd. 326 humans, 260 echoes, being ushered along by two armed metallic Securidroids. Both of them had the words Echo Market Security Officer blazoned on their chests. We were led into the large building. Although my head was full of 9,218 facts about London, not a single one related to Echo Market. But I learned soon enough. Chapter 3 Echo Market was a place where the unwanted echoes like me were bought and sold. It was immediately clear why certain echoes were unwanted. Some were physically damaged or weakened. One had suffered a neck injury that rendered him incapable of speech. Others were suffering malfunctions. One female echo seemed only capable of walking in circles, for instance. Another, a male, kept talking in calculations. One echo had his own Securidroid. He needed to be constantly restrained because he attacked anything that moved. There was another section further along that wasn't full of echoes at all. It was just robots, all looking in pretty bad condition. There were a few of the Travis model, which I knew was over 60 years old. Some of the echoes, though, were a bit more like me. It was hard to see what was wrong with them. We, all the echoes, had to stand inside individual transparent and illuminated booths with information written in fluorescent letters. I remember all this because it is recorded inside me, but at the time it was just a fog. Everything was a fog. The information on my booth was this. Echo 113, Malfunction Class 5. Original manufacturer, Castle Industries. Designer, Rosella Marquez. Nature of malfunction, Rebel. Like the other vendors, Seymour stood in front of the booths that contained the echoes he was trying to sell. Five of them. I was 113. I was no longer Daniel. I looked at the black-haired, handless echo in the box next to me. She gave the smallest shake of her head to tell me that I shouldn't be doing that. Humans kept coming up to the box, asking Seymour questions about one or other of us. The first to be sold was the strong one.
"Oh, yeah, yeah," Seymour told the man and woman who had bought him. 119 will be perfect for providing home security and any other domestic duties you should want doing. Don't worry too much about the humming. You'll soon get used to it.
As the afternoon progressed, more and more of the echoes were sold. To homes and businesses and local governments who wanted to buy cheap. People came up to the booth to ask me questions directly.
"Have you any experience of office work?"
one woman asked me. She seemed friendly. She was wearing a shawl that kept changing colour from purple to black and back again.
"No,"
I said. It took me a while to answer questions. The pain I'd been through had not only made me numb, it had also made me slower.
"But 113 is programmed for various office roles,"
interrupted Seymour enthusiastically.
"In fact, he was created by Rosella Marquez in Valencia, one of the most respected echo designers in the world. And don't worry about his rebelliousness. He's been treated for it."
The woman studied me closely, clicked her fingers in front of my face.
"Maybe a little too treated by the looks of things."
And then she walked away. Seymour closed his eyes in frustration and rubbed a hand through his greasy blonde hair. A man with a long braided beard came up to me. He was from a construction company specializing in self-evolving architecture. He asked me a lot of questions. I answered them. But still, like the woman before, he walked away.
"He's too dull-witted, too slow. There seems to be too much missing."
Seymour lowered my price every hour. I'd started the afternoon at 1,900 unidollars, and now I was down to 650. Seymour kept on putting food into his mouth. He came over to me.
"Okay,"
he said, making no attempt to hide his mouthful of banana.
"When the next customer comes over, be quick on the response. Wake up a bit, okay? Because unless they're looking for a hat stand, you're not going to be sold until after 5. And you know what happens after 5? After 5, the standard of customers falls quite rapidly, and you could end up with any psychotic bargain hunter who comes along."
Seymour had a call from someone.
"I know they were all meant to be sold by now, but there's only one to go. It's 113, the one direct from Castle's place." There's something wrong with him. I don't know what they did when they reconditioned him, but he's not right.
As he spoke, I gazed across the hall at another unsold echo in his illuminated booth, designed to look like a middle-aged human male. He raised his hand to see if I would do the same, but I didn't. And then he laughed wildly for 6 minutes and kept banging his head against the booth, much to his vendor's dismay. 5 o'clock came and went, and I realized that Seymour had been right. The atmosphere changed. The customers who came in now showed no sign of wanting to talk to the echoes. All 15 of us, down from 1,800 at the beginning of the afternoon. They clearly knew that we were rejects among rejects, the lowest of the low. All they wanted was a good price. Seymour sighed as he watched a customer pay another vendor for the echo across the hall, the one who had been laughing uncontrollably.
"Even Mia has sold out before me," he said, shaking his head in disbelief as he gestured to his rival vendor, now on her way out of the hall.
He whistled to a robotic vending machine, which trundled over so that he could help himself to a sweetened red tea. Chapter 4. A skinny man with a long face. He was wearing overalls, and his right eye was totally black, a gleaming black ceramic sphere placed inside the socket. As he came closer, I could smell him. He smelled of ammonia, urine. He just stood there, his tongue clicking inside his dry mouth as he looked at me. If I'd had more wits about me, I wouldn't have liked the look in his eye. It would have made me feel even cheaper than I was. But I had nothing about me right then.
"How much is this one?"
he asked, in a small voice that Seymour didn't even hear the first time. And then he screwed up his face in frustration and repeated louder,
"I said, how much is this one?"
Seymour turned round, looking perturbed at the sight of the man.
"Ah, Lawrence, it's good to see you again." "Louis. My name is Louis."
Seymour nodded.
Sorry, sir, my mistake. It's been a long day."
Louis carried on looking at me shrewdly.
"There are only long days."
"Yes."
I noticed that his dirty overalls had a logo on the chest pocket, a blue castle with three turrets. There were two letters underneath. RZ. This should have troubled me, but it didn't.
"So," said Louis, looking me up and down, "how much?"
"For you, 300, and that's tearing my arm off."
Louis shook his head.
250. Paid now, nothing more."
For a moment, Seymour seemed to be in a quiet type of pain. He took a sip of his tea. Eventually, he nodded.
"Okay, you kill me. 250.
And then he opened the booth door, looking at me almost apologetically before handing me over to my new owner.
"So," he said, noting the initials on Louis's overalls, "how's life at the Resurrection Zone? Made friends with the Neanderthals?"
Louis snarled a little, offended by the question, and said nothing, except to me,
"Come, now."
I was told to follow this Louis out of the hall, which of course I did. I was just another damaged, unquestioning echo at the service and mercy of humans. Chapter 5. I recharged in a lodge right underneath the rotating sphere with 7 other echoes, all male. Most didn't talk to me, although one had before going to bed. He was a bit different to the others. I sat on the edge of my bed and listened to him. All the other echoes were by now in recharge mode, but I wasn't tired. I wasn't feeling anything at all.
"My name is 15, he said. "What is your name?"
I said nothing.
"I'm sorry about the questions. I am a rare model. I was made for inquisitive work. Office jobs, insurance, things like that. The ability to question was part of my programming."
Eventually it came to me.
"My name is Daniel."
15 nodded. He was designed to look like a young man of about 20. He had smart mid-brown hair with a side parting and a face that was designed to be so neutral and inoffensive that you could almost forget what it looked like as you were looking at it.
"I worked in an office, insurance, in Edinburgh. A train crashed into our building. All the echoes that survived were injured, including me. My leg.
totally smashed. He lifted up his trouser leg to show me the damage. I had never seen anything like it. Scarred flesh from his ankle to his thigh. But it didn't shock me. I didn't think anything could shock me again. Means I walk with a limp, which means I am slow. I can't run, and that's not good in here. I'm not exactly made for this type of work in the first place. I'm surprised I have lasted this long. He looked at me for a long time. Thank you for listening to me. None of the others have time for me. I'm designed to be a talker, you see. What was your problem? He asked. Why did you end up here?
I was meant to protect my master, but I left his side when he was in danger, to save a girl.
Why did you do that?
I remembered Audrey's face. I felt the slightest flicker of something inside me, something strange and unidentifiable. I don't know.
What about the others? Do you know if all the other models like you have malfunctioned?
It took me a while to understand the question.
Other models, I said to myself. He leaned in close towards me and then sat back.
No, you're a prototype, aren't you? There is only one of you.
Yes.
He sighed. It was a kind of awe. There are thousands of others like me, he said. Tens of thousands. Except they are not like me. They are better than me. They are not rejects. They can still run, they are faster. Faster bodies, faster minds. But I suppose, if nothing else, being broken makes me different.
He sighed. It might have just been exhaustion. We had better recharge. We need to be alert. It is dangerous work here.
So I lay back and closed my eyes and switched to recharge mode. An image of Audrey's frowning face and intense eyes entered my mind, but it quickly left. And there was blankness again.
Chapter 6. At 5 in the morning, an alarm went off, and I could see all the others leave their beds. You need to get up, 15 told me. I hadn't rested properly. I seemed to need more recharge time since the operation. I tried to sleep through the noise, a distant siren rising and falling in waves, which only reached 61 decibels, but somehow troubled me. Eventually I must have managed to shut off, because the next thing I knew there was a cold shock of water, and I awoke, soaked, to see Louis standing over me with a tin